From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, what the new year holds for Michigan politics with a big election just 11 months away.
A new governor, lieutenant governor, secretary of state, attorney general, the entire state senate, the entire state house.
And races for Congress and the U.S. Senate. We'll get a preview. Plus, sorting out truth from lies on social media before you click the share button.
If it so obviously fits your ideas that you don't even have to look at it, then you should look at it.
Jim Caldwell fired as Lions head coach.
Nice guy. I didn't see any real coaching. He just had the headset on, but like Hoke, he didn't call any plays. He had no input. I never saw his lips move.
Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty and a happy 2018 to every single one of you. We're very, very glad to be back with you. Coming up later this hour, fact versus fiction on social media.
We're all following, like lemmings, following the biggest piece of information off the cliff.
But first, what will this new year bring in Michigan politics? We turn to our It's Just Politics team of Zoe Clark and Rick Pluta. So let's look ahead to this new year. What do you see as the biggest political story for Michigan in 2018?
Well, we are only on day two of 2018, but I think it is going to be something that happens in November. And that, of course, is election 2018, when just in Michigan alone, voters will go to the polls to vote for a new governor, lieutenant governor, secretary of state, attorney general, the entire state senate, the entire state house, and of course, all 14 members of Michigan's congressional delegation.
Boom. Rick, got anything to top that?
How about those apples?
Well, I think I'll just sort of tee off on that. I think the big political story is going to be whether or not we see a wave and in what direction and what that means and how things have developed in Michigan, in the state that is widely perceived as being key to making Donald Trump president of the United States in defiance of expectations.
And this idea of, is Michigan this kind of purple state? Is it now going to be a red state? Is it going to go back to a little bit of its blueness? And what does that mean for this, you know, Midwest state that was a huge part of the Trump win in 2016?
So, Zoe, how could President Trump's popularity and unpredictability affect, let's start with the race for governor, first for the Democrats?
Well, I think for those folks who read the Washington Post today, there was a really interesting article in which Gretchen Whitmer, who is running to be the Democrat nominee here in Michigan, is talked about. And in that article, they mention that 79 women, 49 Democrats, 30 Republicans are thinking about it or have already jumped in to run for governor across the country. Mm. And so I think the idea of women coming out, not just because of the Me Too movement, but also because of some of the statements that this president has made about women. We've seen women's marches last year. There's more coming up. And so what does that look like for female candidates, I think it's going to be really interesting to watch and how Trump, you know, plays into that.
Indeed. And what about his effect on Republican candidates? I mean, we've seen Attorney General Bill Schuette pretty closely aligning his campaign so far with the president, but others not so much.
Indeed. I mean, you've got Bill Schuette, Attorney General, talking about Trump tweeting his support for him, given he spelled Schuette's name wrong the first time, but then they had him do it over again to spell it correctly. I think for Republicans, not just in Michigan, but all across the country in 2018, it is going to be a how close do you get to Trump? And what does that look like for you?
Rick, where do you see the battle lines drawing for this upcoming governor's election?
Well, you know, it almost seems like on the Republican side that it's becoming kind of a proxy battle. MLive did a story that it was kind of a proxy battle between Trump Republicans and Snyder Republicans. But if you look at the people who are actually engaged and employed by both teams, it's almost like a proxy battle between the Trump Republicans and the John Kasich Republicans. And I don't think we can overstate the importance of primaries in this cycle on either side, that if you look at the kind kind of governor that a Bill Schuette would be versus a Brian Kelly, I think you're looking at some pretty substantive policy differences in the same way that I think that you would see a difference between, say, Gretchen Whitmer as governor versus an Abdul El-Sayed as governor. Not that those are the only candidates in either of those races.
But, Rick, I think what you said about this idea of primaries really is so interesting, because more and more in the past election cycles, we see what happens is these candidates, particularly on the Republican side, go very, very, very conservative in the primaries because, well, who turns out to vote? Those
faithful,
who are passionate,
yes,
and faithful. And then in the general have to decide, do you stay to the right? Mm. Do you tack to be more moderate to try to pick up some of the independents? And you know, looking at how that works is going to be fascinating with Trump behind the scenes and all of
well,
this.
Well, two things about that. I think the question is, will Donald Trump and the public's feelings about the performance of the president in Congress in D.C., how will that drive turnout?
Mm-hmm.
And I mean that in both the Republican and the Democratic sides, because as Zoe just pointed out, that it used to be primary elections were sort of a run to the right and a run to the left, and then candidates would tack to the center. Remember Mitt Romney and the Etch-a-Sketch statement,
mm-hmm,
that they were going to, you know, completely reshape the campaign after the primary? Well, elections now are really built on turnout. And just who's inspired to get out and vote based often on ideology, you know, what they believe.
Rick, you think we'll see any surprise candidates in the governor's race, perhaps a certain mayor of Detroit?
Well,
you've left him speechless, and he's speechless. There's a first time for everything.
The window is closing. If Mike Duggan is actually going to get in, and I know that there are a lot of people who are still looking for alternatives, many of them are casting their eyes to Mike Duggan. Macomb County Executive Mark Hackle would also like people to be casting their eyes towards him, but he's been, you know, such a lackadaisical Democrat that I think that's a tough sell. But even at this stage of the game, if Mike Duggan decided to get in January or February, it would create just a primary bloodbath with people going at each other hammer and tong. And so that's why I think that he probably decides to sit it out.
And I don't know if I would have said this 6 months ago, 8 months ago, but let's also look at what that would look like, right? That narrative of here is a strong woman who's worked in the legislature for 12 years running, and then to have a man come in, you know, at mm-hmm. the final minute and go, you haven't been able to kind of finish the deal. I'm coming in to save you, Democrats. And I just wonder, would that suddenly become a narrative? Again, I don't think I would have said that 8 months ago, 6 months ago.
I was going to
say,
in any other period, Zoe, I would quibble with you on
yeah.
that. But I think in this particular moment, you're probably right.
In Michigan's lone Senate race, Zoe, there are some Republicans who've signed up to take on incumbent Debbie Stabenow. Who's got the best chance of beating her?
Well, you know what? Right now, this is where I just think it's too early. Mm. Name ID is very low in this race. And some of this just is because Debbie Stabenow is a powerhouse as a candidate. She's got money as a Democrat. She's sort of found inroads into the Agriculture Committee, who sometimes in West Michigan tend to go more Republican. So really, this is sort of, I think, already shaping up to be another kind of, I don't want to say sacrificial lamb for mm-hmm. Republicans, but it's going to be some heavy lifting for John James. He is running. He is a newcomer to the political scene in Michigan. And then we've also got a former Supreme Court Justice of Michigan running as well. So it's going to be interesting, but again, very, very early days for that race.
Rick, as far as the congressional races, Rick, we've got some open seats with, you know, resignations and retirements and Dave Trott deciding I've had enough. So what are you going to watch on that front?
Well, I think one of the things that we're watching is whether or not the Trott seat, now that it's open, turns out to be competitive. And the big loser, I think, in that particular drama is Gretchen Driscoll, who is mounting a campaign against incumbent Tim Walberg. And they're hoping that in a good Democratic year that she can take him out. A lot of the resources that might be going to that race, I think, are now going to be going to fighting over the Trott seat.
Mm-hmm. And Mike Bishop's seat as well. And again, Cindy, this goes to just how much of a wave does it feel feel like for Democrats. We saw that in Michigan in 2006. We saw it even stronger in 2008. But then a lot of these seats swung back in 2010, stayed with Republicans in 2012 and 2014 and 2016. And so, again, this goes back to my kind of earlier statement about, you know, what color does Michigan turn or get darker or change?
And how do you think all that is going to affect what the state legislature is going to do this year, knowing that this big moment of reckoning is happening in 11 months?
Well, a lot of what the legislature is going to be doing is, first of all, dealing with Governor Rick Snyder's final year in office and what he wants to get done. But we're going to be very, very influenced by what's going on in Washington, that there's probably going to be state activity to deal with the new tax law. You know, Michigan is one of the places that has a state income tax, and so there are ramifications there. The legislature is probably going to want to somehow deal with that, otherwise dealing with angry constituents. Opioid crisis, there's a federal component of that. And I think that really Washington is going to be setting the agenda for Lansing in many respects this year.
Well, certainly it's going to be a year to watch. And I know we'll be checking in with both of you very, very regularly. Zoe Clark, Rick Pluta, our It's Just Politics team. Thanks so very much.
Thanks, Cindy.
Happy New Year.
What is your biggest wish for this new year? We hit the streets of Ann Arbor and Ypsilanti to capture some of our fellow Michiganders' hopes and dreams for 2018.
What I'm wishing for, a stable environment to live in.
I'm wishing that my daughter get a better education.
I want my biggest wish, you know, is to succeed on going to college and probably going to the NBA.
I'm looking toward effective resolution of homelessness crisis.
My biggest wish is to keep my family in my life, have them closer to me, and to keep my relationship tight.
I'm wishing for my family to come to visit me. I'm an international student from Uzbekistan, so I really hope to see my parents and my younger brother.
Just pray to stop the violence. That's my wish.
Better mental health in the new year and just healthier friendships in general.
Honestly, my biggest wish is to stay out of prison. I mean, I got a baseball scholarship right now, and I'm not sure if I lost. I just got out of jail. I just pray for better days. That's all. Just to see a change.
So my wish is when I watch the TV or news, I don't want to see any war around the world.
Just started grad school, so wishing that I can do well in grad school and finish out strong.
Better presidency. Somebody who's not going to make a fool out of us, like, and have us scared that the end of the world is going to happen. I don't think we've had that happen with any president in all the years of our presidency.
Recreational marijuana for our state so we can fund schools, be just like Colorado. We can stop putting people in jail for a plant that's actually medicine.
To focus, go to work more, do my grades, focus in school, stuff like that, yeah.
Peace and prosperity for everyone.
A new car.
This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It's time for our first sports talk of the new year, and we have so much to talk about as we say hello and Happy New Year to Michigan Radio sports commentator John U. Bacon. Happy 2018.
And to you.
And not a Happy New Year for the Lions and former coach Jim Caldwell. Safe to say this firing was no surprise.
I think you and I said this last week. and I've been calling it for a while. A very likable guy by all accounts. The players love the man. The Ford family, not a small thing, of course, in this case, loves the guy.
Oh, the photo of Martha Ford giving him a hug before
the
game Sunday.
And that's throughout the Ford family, I believe.
Yes.
He's a genuinely decent guy. However, he did not succeed at the Indianapolis Colts. He did not succeed at his previous stop, coaching for Wake Forest in the college ranks. And he failed at Detroit with a fair amount of talent, Detroit now has. Nice guy. I didn't see any real coaching. He just had the headset on, but like Hoke, he didn't call any plays. He had no input. I never saw his lips move. So I'm not sure exactly what he was coaching. So he's a nice guy who did not finish first.
And he made it clear when he was hired. I remember that introductory press conference. I'm here to win championships.
Okay.
Never happened.
Fair enough by that standard. Then.
Do you feel at all it was the cards he was dealt with in terms of who was on the team and level of talent?
This is not a Super Bowl title talent bunch. I'll say that. However, it is a playoff bunch. Mm-hmm. It is a you can win a weak division bunch, and they never came all that close to any of those things. So they underperformed. And you're paying Matt Stafford, the quarterback, the biggest salary in the NFL by far, it turns out, and he's not a top five quarterback, but he is quite good. You better get more out of him than that. And talented players are not playing at their best. So time for a change. And Bob Quinn, who will make that call, freshman from the New England Patriots, by far the most dominant team in the NFL the last 17 or so years. He's going to have some very good choices, and he's going to make one. So for the first time in decades, maybe ever, Detroit is most likely going to have a very serious coach.
Really? Well, now, we were hearing that maybe a couple of the top two contenders are both from the Patriots.
No surprise.
Offensive coordinator Josh McDaniels and defensive coordinator Matt Patricia. But any thoughts one way or the other, or even within the Lions organization? I'm seeing defensive coordinator Terrell Austin's name kicked around, or offensive coordinator Jim Bob Cooter.
Those guys have both at various times done good jobs. They'll get interviews. And then it's up to Bob Quinn. Mm-hmm. I am confident of this, that Bob Quinn will get the person that he wants, short of Bill Belichick, the head coach of the Patriots. I think he's got the pull. The Ford family gets a bad rap on this one. They've always written the checks. They've always put their money where their mouth is. They, like Ilitch, they want to win titles. And they've failed to do so, but not through lack of effort or commitment.
But if he brings in a coach and it doesn't happen.
That's him.
That's him. That's on Bob Quinn.
Absolutely. And any GM knows this. If you're the athletic director, you bring in a football coach, doesn't win, that's your coach.
How long should this new coach get to?
You need at least 4 years.
Wow.
So which, by the way, no one has any patience for anymore.
No, they don't.
But that's me saying.
Over to the bowl games, and we are going to start with Michigan. That old saying holds true, clutching defeat from the jaws of victory in the Outback Bowl. I mean, blowing a 16-point lead in the third to wind up losing to South Carolina and ruining the Big Ten's perfect bowl record.
Big Ten was 7-0 in the bowl games, an incredible record. Going to go 8-0, which has not been done in the modern era, if you will. And Michigan, of all the teams, fell short. And this is a team they should have beaten. They're favored heavily to beat South Carolina. Not that great a team. And South Carolina was not that great. Michigan, the second half, was a disaster.
Back in August, at the start of the season, would you have figured this team to kind of have this 8-5 season and kind of go down in flames in the bowl game this way?
I saw them at 9 or 10 wins, so not a great year. Supposed to be probably a slight step back from the year before. But look, they gave away two. Michigan State, they gave away on play calling, and South Carolina, they gave away on play calling, and five turnovers in the second half. You can't do that in a game and win, let alone second half and win. So these two games are giveaways. If you don't do that, you're 10-3 again for the third year. That's coaching.
So who and what needs to shoulder the blame for this disappointing season and this bowl disaster?
At the end of the day, it always falls on the head coach, fairly or not, but there it is. Now, the defense was as good as the offense was, disorganized, unfocused. You've got too many cooks in this kitchen, in my opinion. You've got the offensive coordinator, Tim Drevno, who did very well with Harbaugh on previous stops. You've got Pep Hamilton, who's also deeply involved in the offense.
Both making $1 million.
Exactly right, to be assistant coaches, mm-hmm. let's note. Mm-hmm. That has got to get reorganized. The chain of command is not clear. That's how you end up with a tight end getting the ball in a crucial short yard situation and fumbling the ball before he even gets to the line because it's not his job. So wrong personnel were in there. Call a timeout. This is game 13. Look, here's what it boils down to. I said last year about D'Antonio, everyone's saying the sky's falling in East Lansing. He's done, blah, 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 blah. No, he's not. And you and I said mm-hmm. this. I said, mm-hmm. get back to basics. Forget the 4- and 5-star players. Block and tackle. You'll be fine. He's even better than I expected, frankly, at 10-3. Harbaugh has not forgotten how to coach. Go back to what you did the previous 14 seasons. He's not had a bad year until this year, honestly. So go back to what you're doing there. Remember who you are. Bring back the fire, and they'll be fine.
And we certainly saw that happen in East Lansing, and certainly
exactly.
A great way for
blocking
ending.
Blocking and tackling, man.
Yeah. Now, let's talk about Michigan State. How does it get to that next level? What should it be?
This is where it gets tough for Michigan State because his whole MO, D'Antonio's, is you get 2- and 3-star players, underrated players, you keep them for 4 or 5 years, you coach the hell out of them, mm-hmm. and by year 3, 4, 5, these guys are Big Ten contender teams.
And it's a young team. There's a lot of kids on
this team. It's a very young
team,
and you got a great quarterback, in my opinion, good quarterback, going to be a great quarterback, I think. But that does not bring you to the Ohio State level. It does not bring you to the Final Four level. When they're in the Final Four and you play Alabama, you get swamped 38-0. So I'm not sure if that formula can win you a national title. I'm not sure if the modern fan can accept that, which to me is crazy. I mean, Bo Schembechler never won a national title. He's still beloved in Ann Arbor and should be, in my opinion, of course. I'm biased on that one.
Yeah.
But likewise, D'Antonio, it's not a failure to get the Final Four and lose, I don't think. So if he keeps on rallying off 9-10 win seasons, he's doing a damn good job.
Taking the lessons from this past season and these bowl games with one win and one loss for these teams, what do you think each coach should be doing in this offseason to get their teams ready for 2018?
This one is simple.
Go.
D'Antonio, keep doing what you're doing this year and not last year. And Harbaugh, can get back to what you're doing the previous 2 years and not this past year. So fundamentals, man. Bo in 84 went 6-6. It's the only non-winning season he ever had. And he went to some clinic and saw some hotshot young coach talking about some fancy new offense. And Bo's thinking, wow, the game has really passed me by. And then someone asked the question in the audience. Said, well, if that's such a great offense, how come you were, 6-5 last year? He said, oh, that's easy. We didn't block very well. And Bo said, hot damn, I am back in business because we are going to block well. And, man, no matter how fancy all this stuff gets, give me blocking and tackling. Hang on to the football. You win football games.
Michigan Radio Sports commentator John Eubank. Thanks so much, John.
Thank you, Cindy.
Now we check in on West Michigan's music scene as we say hello again to John Sinkovich, editor and publisher of LocalSpins.com, a website that covers West Michigan's music scene. And we're going to kick off this new year by checking out artists who left their mark on 2017 in West Michigan and some who are likely to generate attention in 2018. And John, we're starting with an artist from Grand Haven.
Yes, he's been actually making noise for quite some time. He's originally from Grand Haven, Garrett Bourns, and he goes by Bourns now. And of course, he's become kind of a pop star that's really caught fire, not only nationally, but internationally. He's about to release his sophomore album, Blue Madonna, on January 12th. And he's actually played Michigan a few times, but he's actually going to play his first hometown show, essentially, in Grand Rapids at the end of January here at the 20 Monroe Live venue. And there are a lot of folks around West Michigan who are pretty excited to finally see this guy live.
Well, let's check out Bourns. This is Faded Heart. Won't you be my consolation? What do you like about his sound?
He has a psychedelic pop vibe that is different than a lot of other pop artists. And I do think that because he came more from a indie folk, indie rock kind of background, that his pop music seems to have a little bit different feel to it and something that at the same time resonates with a lot of young folks. And I remember seeing him when he played a sold-out show in New York on the day that he released his last album, and people were all singing along to his music, and the album had just been released. Clearly, he resonates with a lot of folks.
And speaking of indie folk, let's talk about some other West Michigan artists who made a splash in 2017, starting with the Accidentals. I love the Accidentals.
Yeah, Traverse City's favorite band, so to speak, they really have not only become a favorite in Michigan, but across the United States, pretty much everywhere they play. And the thing that I really like about them, they played two capacity shows this past weekend for New Year's Eve at Founders Brewing here in Grand Rapids, and they continue to incorporate so many different styles into their music, from jazz to hip-hop, to indie rock. They even play some prog rock covers. A lot of fun stuff. And I really think that they are continuing to explore the nether regions of music with their own approach to indie alternative folk.
And we've talked about him on this segment before. Billy Strings. Absolutely amazing. When I'm trying to keep on living.
Yeah, Billy Strings, once again, is anticipating having a big year. I chatted with him not long ago when he was here in Grand Rapids, and he's toured nonstop from coast to coast. He's going to be playing a lot of big bluegrass festivals. Just really fun to see that kid who has so much talent on acoustic guitar getting the kind of attention that he's been getting.
Any chance of seeing either Billy Strings or the Accidentals playing around in Michigan anytime soon?
The Accidentals will be playing a Northern Michigan show in January. Billy Strings will be back, but a lot of his shows are still being booked as we speak. But I guarantee you he'll be back in Michigan this year.
And you'll be covering that at localspins.com so people can get the information by going there. And you want to talk to us about some brand new artists who came out of left field in 2017, or perhaps more accurately, Albion and Marshall.
Yeah, we talked about these two artists before. Jake Kershaw, who's a teenage blues rock sensation, a Marshall High School student, and then, of course, the Warren Treaty, which is a gospel-fired folk and roots act. Both of them have really captivated audiences. Jake, mostly with his sizzling blues rock guitar work. You know, guitar geeks love watching this guy perform on stage. And then the Warren Treaty has gotten a lot of national attention. They're starting to do some work in Nashville. And I think they're going to be releasing another album pretty soon down the road here. And Rolling Stone magazine has even talked about them as well. But I think the band that has made the biggest jump the fastest has probably been Greta Van Fleet. And I think we're going to play a little track from them as well here.
Okay, that seriously takes me back in a great way to more than 40 years to very Led Zeppelin-ish Houses of the Holy era in 73. What a great sound. Where's this band from?
They're from Frankenmuth, of all places, on the east side of the state. But they really, I think, established themselves in West Michigan at places like The Intersection, performing for a lot of bands. They opened for a big band at 20 Monroe Live earlier this year. But they do have a Led Zeppelin vibe, and yet they do it with their own way. I went to their sold-out show at The Intersection on Saturday night this past weekend. You could not believe the enthusiasm of the crowd. I mean, there were so many people jammed into this place, just really cheering this hard rock vibe, and they're very energetic. They keep moving up. They sold out a smaller venue in Grand Rapids the last time we were here. They continue to sell out pretty much every show on their headlining tour. They have a 2018 ahead that I'm sure is going to catapult them to even greater success across the globe.
Yeah, so it's worth keeping an eye and an ear on Greta Van Fleet for sure. Let's turn now to some artists who come out with new releases that could really hit big in 2018, starting with Hannah Rose and the Graves Tones. Tell us about this group.
I've known Hannah for quite some time. I remember the first time I had her on a radio show here locally. People were calling in after she performed to ask who was singing on the radio. She's been around for several years, but she recently assembled a new band. She's got a very soulful, bluesy sound to her voice. She adds elements of funk and rock into her performances. She just had an EP release show at Founders Brewing here. More than 900 people showed up, and she has a super devoted fan base. She definitely intends to perform quite a bit here in the coming year, and I think she may even venture out on tour around Michigan and beyond, so stay tuned for more from her.
And here's a track called Whiskey Neat from the new release, Awaken a Dream.
My coffee was black this morning. You know it didn't taste quite right. The taste that your love left in my mouth. It's a flame that'll never burn out.
So she has recently put together a new band, so she's not so solo now. Who's the band?
The band is pretty incredible. It's really culled from several superstar groups, jazz bands, as well as rock groups from the Grand Rapids and Kalamazoo areas. She really finds a way to surround herself with talent, which really improves the way she performs and in terms of the music that she records as well.
Over to another band that's been in Grand Rapids for a few years. Tell us more about Hiker.
Hiker's interesting because they've progressed from where they started several years ago when they formed here in Rockford, north of Grand Rapids. Their music is electronic pop, has a marvelous airy quality to it. It's got a fair amount of buzz. They earned the band a slot at the Big Audio Tree Music Festival in Kalamazoo this fall. I think this band really has a lot of potential for building its audience, especially in the region.
Let's take a listen to Hiker.
Blue skies, rose glass, and it's just someone telling me.
And we wrap up with Cassidy Bisher, a new face.
He is a new face on Grand Rapids music scene. He recently released his debut EP, Skin, which is a 5-song recording. It really got my attention from the very first time I listened to it. You could describe it, I guess, as anthemic indie rock. It has an atmospheric pop vibe, a little bit of prog rock in its arrangements. He considers himself a studio junkie who doesn't play out a lot, but I'm guessing that after this release, there might be a push to get him on stage a little more often.
Yeah, all right, take a listen to Soldier. This is from Cassidy Bisher. And that is a great batch of artists that you have brought us, John Sinkovich, taking us through this great group of West Michigan artists. You can learn more about them and other acts by going to localspins.com, which is edited and published by John. Thanks so much, and Happy New Year, John.
Happy New Year. Have yourself a fabulous 2018.
Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. Up next, Great Lakes Islanders are banding together to preserve their way of life. We'll hear more about that. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. There are about 32,000 islands in the Great Lakes. About 30 of them have year-round residents, folks who stick it out through the long, cold winter. Now, Great Lakes Islanders are banding together. They're creating a coalition to work together to solve the problems and challenges that they share in common. Michigan Radio's Rebecca Williams joins me now to talk about this. Rebecca, how did this coalition come about?
This is called the Great Lakes Islands Coalition, and it's the brainchild of John Allen and Matt Pricer from the Michigan Office of the Great Lakes. They modeled it after an islands coalition in Maine that's been up and running for a while. And back in September, the first ever Great Lakes Islands Summit was on Beaver Island, and there were more than 70 people from 12 different islands in the Great Lakes who came to this summit. And the whole idea is to bring people from these isolated, far-flung places together because they have common problems that they can work on.
I can imagine those of us who, you know, have lived on the mainland our whole lives could never imagine. What are some of the challenges of island life?
Yeah, it sounds pretty idyllic.
It does.
For those of us who visit only in the summer. But if you live in the winter, you have to think about stocking up on food. Food costs more on the island. Then there's transportation. You have to work with the ferry schedule until the ferry stops running, and then you're looking at flying, and you can't fly if the weather's bad. Some kids can only get to school by plane in Lake Erie, for example. And so those are just some of the practical issues. And then there are much bigger things that people told me they were concerned about, like aging in place. As people grow older, do they have the support systems they need? Daycare is a big issue on islands, not having enough affordable housing, and jobs, of course. All of the islanders I talked to talked about jobs. Tourism is, of course, the big economic driver on islands in the Great Lakes, but that season is really concentrated, and so people end up taking on a lot of side jobs if they don't have regular work. So they're looking at turning their homes into bed and breakfasts or doing construction and kind of cobbling things together. The other huge issue is healthcare.
Oh, I can only imagine.
If you need to get emergency medical care, let's say, Lisa and Russ Broll live on South Bass Island in Lake Erie, and here's what they told me.
We have a paramedic, and we can also buy membership in a Lifelight insurance. So Lifelight comes here pretty, can get you off the island pretty frequently. And we have volunteer fire department and EMS, which I used to be a volunteer EMT here on the island too. Just about everybody's taken their turn at one time or another.
Middle Bass, they didn't have an ambulance, so they load you in the back of a pickup truck to take you down to the airport to fly you off in a helicopter or Lifelight you off.
And they do have an ambulance now, but as you can see, there are just a lot of practical challenges to living year-round on islands.
What's at stake in all of this?
A lot of this is about maintaining a way of life that's been in people's families for generations. I talked to Pam Grasmick. She's the fourth generation of her family to live on Beaver Island. Here's what she told me.
I believe it's the communities.
of islands that make islands special. And I think that's what is at risk through all of this, is that without certain types of support systems in place, there are fragile communities that may well go away.
And she says a lot of people who've chosen to live on islands might not have extended family nearby. And she made a point to me that has stuck with me, which is that a lot of us go and visit islands for tourism, for a vacation, but you have to take care of the people who live on those islands too.
There has to be just something that's hard to put into words as far as what draws and keeps them to living on those islands. And it's worth the sacrifices.
Yeah, I think so. And I ask that question to people too. Why do you come back, or why do you stay here? So many people just talked about that community, that sense of place, but also the security. You know, people don't lock their doors. You know, they know everybody, which has its flip side too. But also just that sense of independence that islanders have of doing things on their own, which is interesting with this project because they're relying on other people. They're getting some help from the state to get this going. People love their independence and they want to do things by themselves, but they see, you know, we can make this a little bit easier too.
Where do things stand now with the Island Coalition?
They've had their first conference call and they're planning a summit for next year on Madeline Island in Lake Superior. And they're starting to get some projects rolling. They've gotten ideas from each other. And so one island's looking at starting a daycare center. Mackinac Island and South Bass Island in Lake Erie are talking about doing a basketball tournament where they fly kids from one island to the other.
Well, you can hear lots more about this topic on today's Environment Report. Rebecca Williams, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
How do we sort out fact from fiction on social media? Do we really want to? Because people are quickly and happily sharing things that are pure fiction, without questioning, without a critical thought. I found myself asking these questions recently when something sprouted up like a weed on my Facebook feed. Some friends, and not people who knew each other, were sharing a story that described an airplane flight crew taking a knee, walking off the plane, and stranding the New Orleans Saints, the flight crew's supposed protest of players kneeling during the national anthem. Somebody would share the story, and then you could read all the comments as friends would pile on. Yeah, that'll show them what America is all about. You get the idea. The thing is, all of these people, including these people I know, were congratulating the flight crew for something that never happened. It's pure fiction. It took me about 60 seconds to track down the source of this story, a satire website which deliberately posts what it calls works of pure satirical fiction, hoping to punk the very people jumping on the story to share it. So I want to talk more about how fiction becomes accepted as fact on social media. And we're going to do that as we say hello to Colleen Seifert, who's a professor of psychology at the University of Michigan. Good to have you with us.
Thank you for asking me.
So does this uncritical, enthusiastic sharing of, I'm sorry, I'll use the term once, fake news, surprise you at all?
Actually, it's something I've been doing research on for a long time. To me, it's really fascinating how you hear a story and it's so good it should be true. And you're so captured by some ideas. What if somebody who we really respected took a knee and made a point? What if there was a reason for hating Hillary Clinton? Those explanations that really connect us and explain our world, they're really compelling and they're hard to forget even when you know they're wrong.
But when you consider the kind of headlines that have been in the forefront of the news since the election, since we learned the term Russian troll farm, which I dare say most of us had not heard, and we became aware the Russian government has set up a spider's web of fake websites and names and bought ads on Google and Facebook, or just plain spread untruths through phony accounts. We've got Congress investigating, but why is it we are so gullible and unquestioning when we see something like that story on Facebook or on Twitter?
Well, I think part of it is it's hard to imagine somebody's going to that length to try to influence my opinion about something. Well, one rule of thumb is, have you ever shared a story that you didn't read? So you see the headline, you see about taking a knee, you see it fits your ideas, you share it to your site for others to enjoy, but you didn't actually open it and read the entire story and determine if the quotes were real or maybe do a little even additional background check. If it so obviously fits your ideas that you don't even have to look at it, then you should look at it.
I want to talk about Facebook, where, you know, you go and you find photos of your friends' kids or grandkids or cat or photos from that night's concert. What is it about Facebook that can make it a petri dish of fake news and lies?
Well, it's interesting. If you ask people, what is the purpose of Facebook? It's surprisingly not to get together with your high school acquaintances and track down long-lost relatives. That's not the purpose, and it's amazing, right?
It seems the way people perceive that? Really? Because that's how I see it. But
exactly.
Go ahead. What do people
see?
So
as a user of Facebook, you feel like it's curated about you. It has all your friends' connection. It's what's happening in their lives, the pictures, the really personal touch to it. You feel like that is its purpose. And I recently asked my class of 30, what is the purpose of Facebook? And that's what they said. It's to connect people socially. That's not the purpose of Facebook at all.
The purpose of Facebook is?
Money. So for Zuckerberg, he doesn't care that I have a connection of friends on the net. What he cares about is that I look at the Facebook page for a certain number of minutes. And if I'm doing that, he can sell an ad space there. So as long as my eyes stay on the Facebook page, he's happy. And anything else on there is only intended to make me keep looking. It's not a benevolent, friendly place to try to improve social relations in the country. That's not the aim. It may be a side effect in some ways. But so if I'm in this environment and I think it's all about my social world, then my guard is down. I am not looking for specific information or questioning it. I'm not even reading the news and being skeptical as I might hear a news story. I'm with my friends. I'm relaxed. I'm sharing stories. I'm interested in their opinions.
And somebody I know shares the story of the flight crew taking a knee, and of course, it's one of my friends.
Right, and it's even more influential that way because we're really influenced by people we know. You know, you read that a certain car has a great reliability, but your friend has a lemon, you don't buy that car. The influence of the individual people we know is much greater than what we do know is better information, the statistics.
So in a sense, this is how we can unwittingly become, we'll say, a patsy for a Russian troll farm, hoping to sow seeds of division in our country, and why we're seeing the heads of Facebook and Google and Twitter being called on the carpet in Congress for not controlling what we're seeing.
We have personal reputations about information. So we know Cousin Bob is not really one to go to for good information, and others, when they pass along a story to us, the story inherits their credibility. Like, I know Susan wouldn't tell me that if it wasn't true. Just like we think a newspaper can't print it if it's not true. And none of those are the case. You have to be as critical a guide in judging your own information from any source now, not just the newspapers.
I'm speaking with Colleen Seifert, who's a University of Michigan professor of psychology, as we talk about how quickly and easily fiction becomes treated as fact and then spreads on social media. Colleen, there was really an interesting story in The Guardian recently titled Our Minds Can Be Hijacked, and writer Paul Lewis talked to a number of those tech engineers who created the very things that we know on Facebook or on our smartphones, like the like button. The guy that created that like button for Facebook is Justin Rosenstein. He now has a parental control feature on his phone to keep him from downloading apps. He has taken himself off Snapchat, cut way back on his Facebook himself. What does that say to you about the technology and this attention economy we're living in and what it's doing to us?
Mm-hmm. We see from people's behavior what an impact it's had. In the pre-digital days, we were not interrupted during a task. We had to seek our own distractions. Now, there's always a source of interruption right next to you. So other people's agendas, other timeframes, things happening in the world, they interrupt you instead of wait till you approach them. So it's a very different psychological phenomenon. It's like you're constantly in a crowd and there's no distinction among the different kinds of sources of information. You're getting your friends, you're getting your relatives, you're getting people you don't know who are supposedly friends of friends. You're getting commercial ads is the main key. And even among the news sources, it seems like there's not a real shared understanding anymore of what news organizations are providing. So when you hear about the New York Times, does that mean that it's good evidence or does that mean you should ignore it because it's a liberal organization? If you hear about Mother Jones as a source, is that a good source or a bad source? So for each specific source, you need to know a lot of information about where it comes from, who's behind it, and what their goal is.
And when you think of back in the day, let's say 40 years ago, you had basically the three networks. You came home and you watched the nightly news at 6:30, and Walter Cronkite would tell you what happened. It was much simpler. You didn't have so many voices competing for your attention.
Right, and like national magazines and newspapers
yes.
delivered to your door.
Yeah.
There's a reputation to uphold for those companies because they knew they had to keep selling you newspapers, so they had to make sure they didn't go too far in one direction or the other. There's none of that. All the rules are gone when you look at information online, and no information is given to you about where it comes from. Sometimes they'll have the source like the New York Times. Other times you can't find the information about where the story comes from.
Which I suspect should be a red flag, such as this story about the flight crew supposedly stranding the New Orleans Saints.
Right. So first it's our obligation to actually click on the link and see if what's actually there. Sometimes there's no story there. Or sometimes you can tell from right away from how it's presented that it's not going to be reliable information. But after that, I think the sites owe us something in terms of providing information upfront about what's offered. The place where you get the information about where it comes from is in the URL, the page label, and that's meant to be machine-readable code. It's abbreviations, it's not kept contemporary, it's full of digits. It's not really intended for humans to read, and that's where we have to get the information about who provided this information. Information about sources should be provided just like a label on your clothes. It tells you where it came from, who produced it, and you have some idea of why they did.
Interesting comment from, again, from Justin Rosenstein, the former Facebook engineer in the Guardian article. And here's his quote. "One reason I think it is particularly important for us to talk about this now is we may be the last generation that can remember life before." Does that send a kind of a chill down your backbone like it did me?
Well, I have a 15-year-old, so I know I'm the last generation who knows these things. And I'm really struck by that in teaching. I imagine that people are being more critical and more savvy about the fact that information is being fed to them, or that the reason for a site's existence is not to be nice to you, but to make money. But it's easy to ignore. It's easy to think that your Snapchat is really about sharing pictures with friends and that you don't have to worry about where they go.
We're lulled. We're very much lulled. And I'll quote one more quote from this piece in The Guardian called "Our Minds Can Be Hijacked," a former Google employee named Tristan Harris. And here's his quote. "All of our minds can be hijacked." And here's this quote. "I don't know a more urgent problem than this. It's changing our democracy, and it's changing our ability to have the conversations and relationships that we want with each other." And again, these are the engineers that designed this technology that we jump to on our smartphones, that have us touching, swiping, or pecking at our smartphones. And I saw one figure, 2,617 times a day. What is the psychology at play here, and what's that doing to our psychology?
One interesting thing about the interruption is that you can train yourself to want to be interrupted. So if you constantly, every 15 seconds or so, are distracted by something else, then your mind only works for 15 seconds and starts expecting the interruption. We habituate to the idea that more interruption is coming. So you don't settle in for a long, thoughtful period. You prepare for the fact that you're going to be interrupted soon. So we do adapt really readily. We figure out the reinforcements, when things are coming, what's exciting for us, and we act towards those things. So that means what they've designed in the social media world is kind of like people crack. It's a version where you can, for your mind, it's mind crack. You can find an environment that will constantly keep you stimulated, where you can choose some directions, but it's being curated for you. So it's providing sensational stories or pictures of the type that you personally enjoy. And it's like a personal movie being shown for you. It's got everything in it you like. It's got people you know there. It feels like you're curling up around the fire. And the important thing is that it's not your friends and relatives that are sending you those messages. It's corporations.
So we've got to keep that in mind. So I love the term people crack. What do you believe is in our country's future if we can't get ourselves off people crack and begin taking a more critical approach to using and sharing on social media?
Well, it's a challenge to convince people that the rate of new information should be slower. As long as we can take in new information, we think it's great. We can opt out of it by closing our eyes or stepping away, so you feel like you have some control over it. But we see the rate of information flow really changing how we're thinking about events. A story comes out, we're considering it, what does it mean, we're discussing it, and then there's a tweet that captures everyone's attention and completely removes the agenda of what we've been discussing. It's like you can distract a room full of dogs with a treat as easily as you can do a single dog. We're all following, like lemmings, following the biggest piece of information off the cliff. So what would have to be different for people to treat information differently and to feel like more information faster is not as good as slow information? Remember the slow food movement? So you could sit back and enjoy the food because it was taking a long time to cook and it was taking a long time to enjoy. And there should be a really slow information movement that we have the time to understand the piece of information given to us, look at all of its sources, figure out how it fits into other things, discuss it with others, and then when we are satisfied, move on, instead of being interrupted by the next piece before you turn the page.
Challenge for the 21st century.
Yes. I think of it like an amusement ride. Of course, it's exciting, but it's also exhausting. So you don't want to be on it all the time. with our social connections, we feel we have to be on it all the time. We'll miss the tweet when it first comes out. We'll miss the photograph that disappears. So we have to be connected at all times. And the sad thing is that that tendency in humans that makes us really human is being exploited, and we're not aware of it.
University of Michigan psychology professor Colleen Seifert, thank you so much for sharing your work with us.
Thank you.
Today's Stateside was directed by Allie Billings. Our engineer was Rusty Brock. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Mike Blank, Sarah Leeson, Mercedes Mejia, and Lindsay Scullin. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so very much for listening.